next matter we're going to take up is the Kumar matter.
Ms. Tyson, Ms. Adelfio just said, why on earth does she get to go twice? I'm supposed to be next.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Whenever you're ready, how much time would you like to reserve?
If I may reserve 3 minutes, please.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Allison Powers of the Fairfax County Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Kumar. And I would like to, since this is a fairly large record, start with the Miranda issue and move on to the chain of custody and then address the motion to dismiss, if that's okay with the Court. Moving to the Miranda issue, the main issue in this assignment of error is the clarity of the request for an attorney. It was clear that the trial court found that Mr. Kumar was in custody. He was in custody in Toronto, and it follows that he stayed in custody when he came to Fairfax. And so the main issue that the court has to consider is the two requests that he brought up, the specific quotes being, I have to talk to the lawyer, and then very soon after that, he says, okay, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. And neither of these requests for an attorney are translated by the traffic officer who is interpreting for Detective Hinson. And I would suggest that these are these requests for an attorney are very clear and are akin to McDaniel versus Commonwealth, where the court found that the statement of, I think I would rather have an attorney here to speak for me, was a clear request for counsel. In that case, that request for counsel came after Miranda was read from the pre-printed Miranda card and prior to the interrogation. And that's the exact same set of circumstances that we have here for Mr. Kumar.
Is there any distinction that the court was able to review a videotape? And based on the videotape and the transcript, essentially indicated that it was not unequivocal in terms of the invoking the Miranda requirements?
Just because the video, while the court did review it, I don't think that there's any distinction, even if there were just audio. The court found that the court adopted, and in this case is somewhat unique in that the trial court, in watching the video, isn't able to hear what Mr. Kumar says. You can follow along in the transcript, and the court adopted the or admitted and agreed that everything in the transcript was what was said. Because
well, you can hear what's said, you just can't understand it.
Yes, exactly. Unless you speak Hindi, yes. And so, yes, you can hear what's said, and there is a, I think notably in between the first request, which is I have to talk to the lawyer, then Officer Iqbal, who is the, and that's at Appendix 35, that Officer Iqbal and Mr. Kumar then have a, are kind of going back and forth, none of which is translated, going through the Miranda forms. And then Officer Iqbal says, if you don't want to answer any question, you feel bothered by any question, you can say you want to talk to your attorney. Immediately after that, Mr. Kumar says, okay, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. And Officer Iqbal's translation of that to Detective Hinson is, I've explained all the five rules, presumably the Miranda rules, and explain, so I assume he waives his rights. And that is obviously not what is said. And since the trial court and the record has that transcript in it, we know that's not what was said, and we know that he did, in fact, request an attorney.
Didn't the trial court also make its determination in reference to whether there was the invocation of his Miranda at the earlier part of the conversation with the detective, that later he was clearly able to invoke those rights and clearly did so? Is that
he?
You would place that?
There is a later portion where the rights are invoked and Detective Hinson is made aware of that, and so the interrogation stops at that point. I think that the distinguishing factor with the two initial requests are that Detective Hinson doesn't know that those happened, so he can't evaluate whether he's requesting an attorney or not. And since that transcript is part of the record, this court can evaluate those two different statements, which are, in fact, very clear. And it's clear in Miranda and all the case law that follows it that the specificity of words is extremely important when one is requesting an attorney, because, you know, we have Midkiff and Mueller where the court found that they were not clear, and so the court looks at every single word and the context that it's made in, and in this case, that didn't happen because the translation didn't occur. But we have the benefit of having that in the record, admitted at the suppression motion, and so we can say that those requests were very clear.
But I think to the point that Judge Malvo was getting to or asking you about, because he so clearly invoked later on during the course mm-hmm. of what we can certainly call a custodial interrogation, mm-hmm. isn't the trial court able to look at how clear that invocation was, and then with the benefit of having it by video so he can hear, even if he can't understand the words, hear the tone of voice, mm-hmm. hear whether he appears to be relaxed, upset, uncomfortable, observe mm-hmm. his mannerisms on tape, and then hear words that when it's being described to him as though the suspect at that time is just repeating back what he understands to be his rights mm-hmm. in the face of such a clear invocation later. Isn't that something the trial court's enabled or allowed to consider? The differences between those two supposed invocations of the right to counsel?
I think it's certainly something the court can consider. I don't know that on the record we have any evidence that that kind of comparison was done, because there was so much confusion at the beginning of this lack of translation, and the fact that immediately after the Miranda rights are read, Mr. Kumar says, okay, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. I mean, it couldn't be clearer that he has now requested an attorney for a second time, and that is not being honored. And then Iqbal goes on to say, well, you know, I assume he waives his rights, and Detective Hinson knows nothing, that nothing is amiss, and continues on to the
question. Was it at that time that he was asked, do you want to answer my questions? And he says yes.
He says,
or do you want to talk to me?
Do you want to talk to him? And I believe is the quote, and I can double check on that. And there is no, it is not clear, since the previous question is, or sorry, the previous statement by Mr. Kumar is, okay, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. And Iqbal's immediate follow-up question is, you want to talk to him. There's no determination of who him is. Is him the attorney? Because Mr. Kumar has just requested that he talk to an attorney. Or is him Detective Hinson? And all Detective Hinson knows is that Officer Iqbal has said, well, I explained all of his rights to him, and I assume that he waives them.
But the court, in making a factual finding of whether he clearly and unambiguously invoked his right to counsel, can look at the fact that if there's no reference to who him is, yet he answers questions right after that, then could there be a reasonable inference that by him, he certainly knew it was the officer, because he goes on to then answer the questions until he tires of answering more pointed questions mm-hmm. and does invoke very clearly and unambiguously.
I think that's one possibility, but in the context of when these two requests happen, Mr. Kumar requests an attorney, I have to talk to the lawyer. Officer Iqbal continues to talk to him, and then he says, okay, I will talk to the attorney and then answer immediately after being informed that he can have an attorney.
But if that's one possibility and one reasonable mm-hmm. possibility, doesn't that hamstring us a bit at this stage when we're reviewing a factual determination made by the court?
I think this case is extremely unique because of the lack of that translation. It is not that Detective Hinson heard these two statements and then continued on. You have this middle person who is inaccurately, not even just inaccurately, he's summarizing things that aren't even happening. And so that is what puts us kind of in a much more unique and different position than a lot of the other Miranda cases.
Didn't the trial judge conclude that with respect to the statement, I have to talk to an attorney, that Mr. Kumar was simply repeating the reading, what was being read to him as a Miranda right? Is that a finding of fact that binds us?
I don't believe...
I find he was simply repeating the rights that were told to him. That's what the trial judge said.
The trial judge did say that.
Is that something we can look behind and say, no, that wasn't a simple repetition of what was being told to him?
I believe that this court can, because the record is very clear that it's not actually a repetition
it's
of what's being happened.
It's not?
Yeah, he when he says, Officer Iqbal says, as evidence, you have the right to talk to your lawyer when we question you. You can say that you cannot answer. Mr. Kumar then says, I have to talk to the lawyer. And then Officer Iqbal says...
Well, that could be simply a restatement.
It could be. I don't think read in the context that it is a restatement, because he is...
The tone of that would have been... The tone with which he said have to would have been important.
Potentially, yes. And that's, again, where we get into the problem. While you can see, you know, you can listen to the tone, whether you can match up the words between English and Hindi in the tone, I mean, that's obviously something that would have had to have been much deeper than we went.
You can look at body language.
You can.
At those phases. But, by the way, the trial court, is this correct? Is my correct interpretation here? The trial court essentially said the same thing, but with additional words. With respect to, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. Trial court said that was simply a repetition of something that had been read to him without not being an invocation, in other words. It was a repetition, not an invocation.
That is what the trial court said.
So,
yes.
Again, if that's treated as a determination of fact, I'm not sure that we're, you know, why you say we're not bound by that.
Because I think the record is in direct contradiction to that. The record that, because the trial court, in fact, said, I don't care whether or why he didn't translate for the officer, in saying that he thinks that they're repeating the rights, because the record itself, this transcript, is extremely clear that he's not, in fact, repeating the rights that were just read to him.
Now, after Judge Annunziata initially asked you the question, you'd answered, and she said, is that an interpretation the trial court made? You essentially said, and you said it much more articulately than I will now, that could be an interpretation, but essentially I think you were interrupted, but it sounded like you were going to go on to say, but you don't think it's the right interpretation. But if something could be an interpretation and it's a factual issue, doesn't that mean, as she was asking you, that we owe that finding deference, as long as it could be made, could reasonably be made?
In terms of it being the trial court's finding that it was a repetition and
yes,
not
ma'am.
An invocation, I would go back to the actual record itself and the transcript, because that it's just not what happened. He's
but
not.
But you can't consider the transcript without the video that the trial judge watched and was somewhat persuaded by in terms of someone's manner.
Presumably, the trial court emphasized the fact that. He had watched the video. I don't recall there being any long discussion about the specific mannerisms or anything that went on in the video. I think he merely mentioned, look, I have reviewed this video, and I have reviewed the transcript prior to this hearing.
Ms. Powers, not to interrupt you, but you're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, and I will save, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Adolfio, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. To address the Miranda issue, the trial court properly denied the motion to suppress where it considered not just Kumar's words, but also the context of his statement. As the court has noted, the trial court had the opportunity to observe the tape of the interview and observe the defendant's demeanor and his body language. The trial court's determination that Kumar was merely confirming his understanding of his rights was not plainly wrong. Given the fact that given a review of the video where the defendant appears to just be merely parroting words back to the police officer who's translating for him.
Ms. Adolfio,
I would just briefly want to...
Ms. Ms. Adolfi, let me interrupt you for a second. This is Judge Malvo. A quick question for you. What Mr. Kumar indicates is could be looked at as not being simply just a parroting, because he essentially says, I will talk to a lawyer, then answer questions. And if you're parroting back, wouldn't it be a natural thought that essentially what he would parrot back is what is stated in the Miranda, which is you have a right to speak with an attorney, and not quite in the phrasing or the order in which it's presented that Mr. Kumar states. Wouldn't it be more accurately looked at as an invocation of his Miranda rights?
I think that the trial court looked at the tone and the body language of the defendant, and frankly, given the fact that there were a number of languages being spoken, I think that words don't necessarily translate exactly between multiple languages. So there might not have, it's hard to say how those words, how the different dialects translated exactly into English.
Well, we have a translation of it in which Officer Iqbal is essentially indicating that you've got the right to speak to a lawyer, and he's actually going through the Miranda readings, which is slightly different than what's being parroted back. So I guess what I'm asking is, why would that not be plainly wrong in reference to the court's interpretation of it being merely a parroting back when, in fact, it appears it doesn't mirror exactly what Iqbal says?
My response was twofold. One, we don't know exactly how Kumar interpreted the language that was spoken to him by Iqbal, because Kumar and Iqbal did not speak, their native languages were not the same, and they were speaking to each other in languages that were close to each other, but not exactly the same. And two, and I'm sorry, now I can't remember what language Kumar was speaking, but that language might not have the exact same translation to English as what Iqbal was speaking. So there might not have been a one-to-one correlation with respect to the statements being made.
Mr. Delphio?
And I just note, I mean, yes, Your Honor.
You can finish. I did just have one other question. Did you finish what you wanted to say?
Your Honor, I'm happy to defer to you, but I'm happy to answer whatever question you might have.
I don't know if in the record there is anything that suggests that what Mr. Kumar was being asked was something like this. Do you understand that you have the right to speak to an attorney and then can, before you answer questions? Because some of these answers that are taking out of context, I think there's an inference that he was simply saying, I understand, I can have an attorney and then speak. Is there something in the record that supports that view that was the trial court was considering?
Your Honor, the Commonwealth multiple times attempted to attack the translation of the record before the trial court and argued to the trial court, both in writing and orally, that the translation was not exact. The trial court's response was, it doesn't really matter. I've looked at the tape, and based on the demeanor and the tone of the defendant in the tape, I know that he was merely confirming his understanding of the rights.
He was
and
confirming
I
discussed
that in a footnote.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He was confirming his understanding of the rights, and I'm wondering what in the record. Is there anything in the record that supports the trial court's conclusion? He was confirming his understanding rather than invoking, I guess. I thought that was kind of interesting, but perhaps there's nothing other than that. That's how the trial court interpreted what was going on. Mr. Kumar was confirming his understanding that he could ask for an attorney and then answer. Okay, that's fine. Leave it there. I don't want
I'm looking at appendix page 35, where Iqbal says, you have the right to talk to a lawyer when we question you. And Kumar responds, I have to talk to a lawyer. And Iqbal then responded back to Kumar, I have to talk to the lawyer. He will talk to you. And Kumar responds, okay.
Yeah, Mr. Duffler. I hate to interrupt you, but further down on that same appendix page, it also indicates where Iqbal is asking a question. He says, if you don't want to answer any questions, you feel bothered by any questions, you can say you want to talk to your lawyer. And it's at that point where he says, okay, I will talk to a lawyer and then answer questions. How do we read that as anything other than an invocation of his Fifth Amendment right? Because it's separated out from the part where arguably it could be parroting back. Would that be a place where the court might have been plainly wrong?
I think the answer is exhaustive. If you don't want to answer a question, you can talk to an attorney, and Kumar's response can be interpreted, okay, if I don't want to answer any question, I'll talk to an attorney, and then I'll answer it.
Ms. Adelfio, may I ask you, it's somewhat similar to a question I asked your adversary, and that's what essentially are we to make of the later very clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel by Mr. Kumar? Does that play into how the trial court could view the earlier statements and concluding from a factual perspective that he was just parroting back his rights versus invoking the right to counsel?
Your Honor, I think that Stevens versus Commonwealth, which is found at 283, Virginia 296, 2012, makes clear that post-request responses to questioning may not be used to cast doubt on the clarity of an initial request. So you may consider circumstances before an invocation of rights in determining whether or not the invocation of rights is ambiguous or not, but later interactions are not appropriate.
Well, and I think that's what I mean, because if the trial court is saying that the earlier statements are not an invocation, but obviously the later one is an invocation, he's allowed to consider what happened beforehand, and if he's saying that, look, I don't find this to be a clear and unambiguous invocation, certainly the later one was, but what happened before that, I don't find to be a clear one, and this is why. Can you look at the fact that later on he was able to do it so clearly and understandably as a way of helping to interpret the earlier pre-invocation statement that really all he was doing is parroting back his rights?
I think that post-request responses, I think it's appropriate to consider only the circumstances prior to an invocation in determining whether or not a statement was ambiguous or not. I would note, Your Honor, that even if the trial court erred in admitting this Kumar statements, the evidence against him was overwhelming and any error was harmless. The court had before it the victim. First, Kumar's statements were not nearly as damning or negligible in the grand scheme of the Commonwealth's evidence against him. The evidence against him was comprised of the victim's testimony regarding the assault, the fact that the defendant was the only man in the apartment at the time of the assault. His sperm was found in the victim's underwear. He then fled the country after he had been indicted and while the prosecution was pending against him. And he made a number of inconsistent statements regarding his actions that day and initially lied even regarding whether or not he was in the apartment at the time. And those inconsistent statements happened immediately after his arrest, not during the conversation that is the subject of the Miranda challenge. So given all of this evidence against him, to the extent that his statements regarding the mistake he made, that statement, the admission of that statement is harmless given the Commonwealth's overwhelming evidence against the defendant. And unless the court has any other questions with respect to the second assignment of error, I just briefly turn to the first assignment of error. And I note that the trial court properly denied the motion to dismiss the indictment because, first, the chattel and the bedding were not inherently exculpatory at the time that the Commonwealth, destroyed the evidence. And the Commonwealth clearly did not destroy the evidence in bad faith. Kumar has merely expressed in his brief a hope that his DNA would not have been present on the towel on the bedding, and given that this is pure speculation that this evidence would have been exculpatory does not satisfy the standard constitutional standard of materiality with respect to the test regarding this evidence. Furthermore, Kumar did not show that the police acted in bad faith in the destruction of the evidence. There's no evidence that the police agents had any knowledge of the allegedly exculpatory nature of the towel and the bedding. And in other cases, the Supreme Court of Virginia has affirmed no bad faith where state agents knew further testing may have been conducted. And that's the Lovett case. Here, where the state agent clearly thought that the case was over, her actions in ordering the destruction of the evidence were even less indicative of bad faith. And so, with respect to the first assignment of error, the trial court properly denied the motion to dismiss. And, Your Honor, I regret to say I'm not sure how much time I have left.
You have 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Then, with the court's indulgence, I turn to the chain of custody issue. And I would argue to the court that the trial court properly admitted Tumwalt's Exhibits 11 through 15 and 23 through 25. The destruction of the perp kits and the witnesses' reliances on their notes did not negatively impact the establishment of the chain of custody. The Commonwealth merely has to establish with reasonable certainty that the chain of custody was proper. And here, the Commonwealth certainly showed with reasonable certainty that this evidence had not been altered, substituted, or contaminated prior to testing. Every single witness who testified stated that the exhibit were sealed, that there was no appearance of tampering when they received them at various points in the prosecutorial and investigative processes, and there was no evidence other than speculation on the part of Kumar that this evidence had been tampered with at any time. Accordingly, the trial court did not abuse its discretion in admitting the evidence and letting any possible doubt with respect to this evidence go to the weight of the evidence and making those issues a jury question. The Commonwealth does not have to exclude all conceivable possibilities of alterations and substitutions. They merely have to show this reasonable certainty that the evidence was not tampered with. And very briefly, I turn to the fourth assignment of error. The trial court did not err in denying Kumar the request of jury instruction with respect to the destruction of the evidence. There was not a scintilla of evidence that the police destroyed the exculpatory evidence in bad faith for the reasons previously discussed with respect to the first assignment of error. But Kumar was not able to point to any evidence linking the towel or the bedding to the sexual assault other than the victim's statement that her assailant cleaned up with the towel. And he has not shown that the towel or the bedding would have been exculpatory, especially because at the trial he testified to the jury that he had had sex with a woman in the apartment while the victim was present, and he had cleaned himself up with the towel and the bedding. So if his DNA had not been found on the towel and the bedding, that would somewhat have belied his claim that his testimony, it would have contradicted his testimony at trial, and it would have called his credibility of testimony with respect to that.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you, but your time is up. Thank you, though, for your argument.
Thank you for consideration. I appreciate it.
Ms. Farris?
And I will just touch briefly on the Miranda and then move to a bit of a response about the chain of custody. I think the statement, again, is plainly wrong in face of the transcript, because the statements that Mr. Kumar is making are not parroting back. He says, I will talk to the attorney and then answer. That is clearly saying it's not parroted. That's not a Miranda right. He is told the right that you can talk to an attorney. He says, okay, I will do that, and then I'll answer the questions. And the Commonwealth talks about how the words don't translate exactly. And in this case, while Iqbal has says the languages are not the same, we have the benefit of the transcript. And the court, even though the Commonwealth argued the transcript isn't correct, the court agreed and admitted that as a correct transcript. And so we have to rely on that.
At what point Mr. Kumar begins speaking English, does he know?
He speaks English about some biographical information.
Does it matter that he apparently knows English? Does it matter to anything that we're looking at?
No, I don't think it does, because in the context of the Miranda rights, he is not speaking in English, and those are obviously...
But the implication is that he understood... Was he looking at it? Was English ever used to present the Miranda rights to him?
No, it was not. They were never read in English.
And he did not answer in English.
He did not answer any portion of that in English. And certainly I would say that this is not harmless error. One, because the statement
I need to interrupt you. Your time's up, but since we launched in a couple questions, I'll give you an extra minute, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor. The error is not harmless, and in looking at Zekta and Deering, the Commonwealth talks about the evidence is cumulative and overwhelming, and that kind of leads us into, one, the fact that the Commonwealth did rely on his statement very heavily, his statement, I made the mistake and so I left, and then if you couple that with the massive problems that there are in the chain of custody, and I think one way to kind of sum it up very briefly is that piece of cloth that Ms. Delfield referenced in her argument, saying that that Mr. Kumar's DNA was found on the complainant's underwear. And we certainly don't know that to be true. There is a piece of cloth that was used to extract a DNA sample that is consistent with Mr. Kumar. But the problem we have with that is that we have no idea where that piece of cloth came from, because the perks were destroyed, so it could be. All we know is that it was Carter's, I believe they said white underwear, no distinction of size, if it's male or female. And so ultimately, that could have been from Mr. Kumar's perk. It could have been his own underwear, which would certainly fly in the face of the DNA evidence that the Commonwealth challenged.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt.
Sorry. I will submit on my brief and ask that the court grant this petition.
All right. Thank you. Come down and greet counsel. I think you've signed in.
Yes, I have.
Perfect. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Duffy. I'm going to disconnect now.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yes, thank you very much, Ron. I appreciate it.